we'd like to reserve 5 minutes of our time for rebuttal.
Got it.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. On behalf of the City of Fernley, Dave Rigdon, I have with me in the audience the Honorable Neil McIntyre, Mayor of the City of Fernley, here to observe these proceedings. Fernley is a city of 20,000 residents that's located approximately 35 miles east of where we're standing here today. Those residents currently rely exclusively on groundwater to serve the drinking water needs of that community. It's no accident that the town of Fernley was created in 1905, the same exact year that the canal was completed. Fernley doesn't have natural water resources. Unlike Reno, it doesn't have a river that runs through it. Unlike up at the communities up at Tahoe, it doesn't have a lake it can draw off of. There's not a lot of natural water resources out there. And it wasn't really a natural place to put a city. But in 1905, the Bureau of Reclamation built a river through the town, the canal, and encouraged, and they did so for the specific purpose of encouraging residents to come out and settle that area and build up there in reliance on the water that they were providing from the canal.
When you say from the canal, you mean that seeped into the ground and in the aquifer or directly from the canal?
Both. The water that directly pulled out of the canal was used for irrigation purposes and to create farms out there. And the water that seeped in was used for the municipal water supply through permits that were issued by the state engineer.
This case feels a little funny because in some ways what you want is you want some of that water from the canal, but you want the water that has been coming from the canal through the groundwater and replenishing your aquifer. And why haven't you, or maybe you have, I guess one question is, why wouldn't you bring a suit like that in state court and say that you have some sort of water right, I don't know what it would be, but some sort of water right to that water. And so if they line the canal and keep it from seeping in and getting it sort of indirectly that way, you should just get some water straight out of the canal or something. Is that something you...
Quite frankly, that's not ripe yet because we haven't actually received the damage of the loss of water to the aquifer yet. So, yes, when that becomes ripe, we have a state issued permits to use that groundwater. Those state issued permits were issued.
It would be a state law issue, I guess, decide whether it was ripe, but it feels like it'd be pretty ripe when you have an agency that says we're going to do this. Your only way of stopping an agency is to get a federal court to stop the agency, which is what you're trying to do now. But I would think it'd be right because you say they're going to do this. They're going to take, we need to plan as a city and we would like to know whether or not we're going to be able to get that water if they do what their plan is to do.
Well, we haven't done it yet. We're trying to pursue this path of looking at the environmental review of the project itself.
It's pretty indirect. I mean, basically you're saying, there's some environmental review that wasn't done, and so what we want water, understandable why you want and need the water, but we want the water, so we're going to try to get it, whereas, really the state courts would tell us whether or not you actually have a right to the water.
Well, we can't go to state court because we have the federal government involved here, and so this would have to be brought in the federal division that these people work for.
They have to. It's a rare instance that they have to litigate water rights claims in state court. That's not so. The federal government being involved in a water rights case has to litigate in state courts. I'm not sure you're right about that. I guess we could ask the government.
Well, the Ore Ditch Decree was decided in federal court. And so this would come under the auspices of the Ore Ditch Decree, which is why originally when we brought this case, we did bring a supplemental jurisdiction claim to the right to that water because we were in the same court that we were in the Ore Ditch Court, essentially, when we brought that claim. That claim was dismissed. And the court declined to exercise that supplemental jurisdiction over it. But we did actually bring that
claim. I don't
want
to take too much of your time. I'm still not sure exactly why you seemed like a state court would be a pretty favorable venue for you to actually say, we deserve this water. And then, in some ways you wouldn't care because you'd be like, you can line it and just give us the water straight out of the canal, or you cannot line it and give us the water indirectly.
Well, if we could do it in state court, we would do it in state court. But unfortunately, and I think Reclamation will tell you that we couldn't do this in state court. I think the Pyramid Tribe would tell you we couldn't do this in state court because these water rights are under Claim 3 of the Ordis Decree. So we have to bring it in the actual decree court, which is the federal court. So I don't think there'd be any disagreement between the parties on that fact. And that's important because that Claim 3 of the Ordis Decree, the part that they don't tell you about in their briefs, is where it says, yes, the water's to be used for irrigation, but it specifically and expressly says the water from the canal is to be used to support the inhabitants of towns and cities that will grow up along the canal. They specifically anticipated this in that Ordis Decree.
I guess the reason I'm asking this is we're supposed to decide all of this. I understand it's a bit of it's not exactly the same thing, but we're supposed to decide all this. And it's a big unknown whether you have a right to the water, right? That seems to be the elephant in the room. Do you have a right to the water? So I was assuming that would have to be brought in state court, but maybe it has to be adjudicated by federal court. But why is that not? Because if you don't have a right to the water, then your NEPA claim that they didn't take into account something that you don't even have a right to sort of is pretty...
I don't think the NEPA claim relies on whether we have a right to the water or not. We do. We believe we do have a right to that water. But regardless of whether that's adjudicated, and this is why the district court declined supplemental jurisdiction over that issue,
we have an environmental impact, because originally, remember, you said it was economic impact. And you say we have an environmental impact from the fact that we're not going to have this water. But if you don't have a right to, it's an odd thing to say we have an environmental impact from not having something that we have no right to have.
Even if we don't have a right to the water, the federal government still has to study the environmental impacts of what the loss of that water is to the environment. And that's what our case is here. Our case is here is they didn't properly study what the environmental impacts of the loss of that water are to the environment.
But even the environmental question, I think, whether somebody has a right to something would weigh even on the environment. Because you say, well, this is going to be some environment. There's going to be some environmental impact, say. But if I was trying to evaluate the environmental impact, part of the calculus would be, do you have a right to that thing that you're saying taking it away will affect the environment? It's hard to evaluate because part of the thing might be, well, you don't have a right to it, so it's going to go away at some point anyway. But I don't want to sidetrack you, but I'm just...
Let me get on to the environmental issues that we have with this. When Congress passed NEPA, they set up, and we all know the mantra, NEPA is a procedural statute. It doesn't require substantive determinations. It's purely procedural on its face, and that's all true. But Congress passed those procedures with a purpose in mind, and it was a substantive purpose. And they believed that if those procedures were properly followed and were followed in good faith by the agencies, that the agencies and the agencies were fully informed that the decision makers in those agencies would change their projects or alter the projects in a manner that could avoid those environmental impacts. And that's quite frankly why the lack of any mitigation discussion in this EIS is so important, because under the Robertson case that the Supreme Court decided that we cite to in our brief. Under that Robinson case, they note that the mitigation discussion is super important, because what it does is it forces the agency to look at the severity of the impacts. Because by looking at if something can be easily mitigated, then it's not really severe, and then you can go forward. But if something can't be easily mitigated, if it's going to cost millions of dollars to mitigate it, then we know there's a super severe impact here. So the Bureau's lack of including this mitigation discussion, and by the way, the Supreme Court specifically said that the purpose of that mitigation is to force action. There was a substantive purpose to that. It's action. It had an action-forcing purpose behind it to force the agency to rethink their action before causing that super high impact thing that's going to cost a lot of money to try to mitigate.
Why doesn't the alternative that the government chose demonstrate that it thought about mitigation?
I'm sorry.
Why doesn't the alternative that the government went with show that it was considering mitigation?
the government didn't consider mitigation here. They didn't. The only thing that they point to that they say was a discussion of mitigation, which is not actually in the mitigation.
They didn't choose the option to fully line this canal. They didn't choose that option. They chose something less than that. Why does
no? They chose to fully line it, but with two miles on the very tail end, which if you look at the studies about the aquifer, not lining that tail end, that 2 miles on the tail end, does nothing to help recharge the aquifer in the part of town, because there's faulting that occurs and there's a groundwater divide. So they're choosing not to
so
do 2 miles.
You wanted a section in the EIS specifically titled mitigation, where that's the argument?
They don't specifically title mitigation. They call it environmental protection measures is what they call their mitigation discussion in this EIS is environmental protection measures. And if you look through those environmental protection measures, there's literally nothing in there about how to mitigate the loss of recharge to the aquifer. I want to be sure and preserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I'm past the 10 minutes now.
All right, we'll go ahead and get round up to five.
Thank you very much.
Got it.
I think the clock, oh, perfect. May it please the court. My name is Caitlin Skoulon, and I represent David Stix and Dina Edmondson, which are the intervener appellants in this case. Before I jump in, I just want to touch on the mitigation question that was just brought up. We agree with the city of Fernley that we don't believe the mitigation discussion is sufficient for two reasons. First is that the then applicable implementing regulations for NEPA required that the mitigation discussion go beyond the proposed action and the action alternatives. So there had to be some discussion beyond that action that was chosen that addressed mitigation measures. Additionally, there was some reliance in the Bureau's briefing on the Robertson versus Methow Valley Citizens Council. And in that case, the United States Forest Service was discussing the issue of mitigation and looked at both mitigation that it would take within the project area, as well as mitigation that would occur by local governments outside of the project area. And if looking at the NEPA documents in this case, the mitigation measures that are discussed in that environmental measures section are those measures that are going to be taken by outside local governments, such as the city of Fernley. There was not any discussion on what mitigation measures would be taken by the agency within the project area. I'd like to address briefly the issue of agency deference in this case. In 2004, the Supreme Court eradicated Chevron deference and didn't really present the courts with a new test for agency deference. Rather, it reverted back to the deference that was outlined in an earlier case entitled Skidmore versus Swift. In that case, there were three factors that a court should consider in determining whether or not to defer to agency decisions. And those are the thoroughness of the agency consideration, the validity of the agency reasoning, and the consistency of the agency with earlier and later pronouncements. And we believe that all of those factors are lacking in these NEPA documents.
How does your argument square with Seven County?
Thank you, Your Honor. So the Supreme Court in 2025 in the Seven County case did recognize that there was certain deference in NEPA cases, but it did cite back to the Skidmore case. So that Skidmore test in how to apply the deference, we believe still applies in light of the Seven County case. The heart of the NEPA analysis, of course, is threefold. The agency was required to look at impacts, at reasonable range of alternatives, and at mitigation measures. I've already spoken about mitigation. To go to the issue of alternatives, we believe that this really fails on the consistency of the agency with its earlier positions. If you review the record, there were studies in 2013, 15, 16, and 17 that looked at a variation of different alternatives. And all of those studies included multiple alternatives that did not include lining the canal. Those non-lining alternatives were feasible. They met the project purposes. And in many cases, they were preferable to lining alternatives for a myriad of reasons. In 2020, the draft EIS took an about face and eradicated all of those non-lining options, and there was very limited reasoning for why those lining options weren't included.
I wanted to ask a little bit about that point, I guess. In your brief, I think it's your reply brief, you say that the government fabricated an excuse not to use the cutoff wall option. And I'm wondering what in the record shows that there was a this fabrication of an excuse.
Your Honor, we believe that the reasoning to not use the synthetic cutoff wall was very limited, in that the Bureau stated that they did a study and they tried to drive those walls into three discrete locations within 9 miles of the canal that they had previously indicated was suitable for that technology. And so we believe that limited study was insufficient to show that those cutoff walls would have been a good option in other locations in the canal.
Doesn't Seven County instruct us that we're supposed to give deference to an agency in terms of the studies that it engages in and how it does its investigation of these issues?
Yes, Your Honor, but it also incorporates that Skidmore test, which requires you to look at whether or not the government's position is consistent with its earlier positions, and all of the studies prior to that embankment study indicated that that was a preferable option.
But wouldn't it seem logical that, yes, maybe we have in the past information that led us to one conclusion, and then we get new information that leads us to a different conclusion and we change our mind? That doesn't seem illogical to me.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but we believe that the scope of that test was too limited to have been a complete evaluation of that option. And it looks like I am out of time.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Margot Carter for the federal defendants. Mr. Mixon from the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe is seated at counsel's table, and I will be taking the full 20 minutes today.
Very well.
The district...
Can I just ask you, I don't want to take much time, but where would it... I assume at some point it'll have to be adjudicated whether Fernley has a right to this water, which they've had for, sounds like, over a century. Where would that be adjudicated? They were saying it would not be in state court.
So I think in Fernley 1, there was some discussion of the water rights, and it would be adjudicated by a state court. And I think there was a state court determination, it was like that we cited in our brief in Fernley 1, that said that there was no permitted right to seepage
That was a precedent from state court, or was
it was
that
the it was like a Nevada was... state engineer opinion number 6047, and I think we cited to it in our brief in Fernley 1.
So is it your position that it has that we know that they don't have? I know it's not really.
I think it's not clear, and it's not really part of this case. Which really, it's not. This case is really not about water rights. This case is about NEPA and whether or not the government did enough.
Would it be relevant to the NEPA? And my instinct is that it would have some relevance to the NEPA analysis for somebody to come in and say there's going to be an environmental impact from this action, and we don't. And the difference of whether they have a right to the things that they're saying would mitigate the environmental impact would seem to be relevant. And Beth, my instinct is it's relevant somehow, but.
I'm not really sure it's relevant only because that really goes to whether or not they have an economic interest in that water as opposed to...
But economic, I mean, as this case illustrates, got dismissed for lack of it, they just repleted as a lot of economic things, you know, environmental mitigation measures cost money, et cetera. So I'm not sure that saying that they're not, that it's, you know, it's not like two separate categories that don't overlap. And so... I can imagine an agency doing an NEPA analysis saying this will have some environmental impact, but state law, like assume that like it had been adjudicated black and white that they did not have a right. State law does not give them right to this water. In fact, state law gives other people this water. They don't, you know, they're at the bottom of the ladder instead of the top. And so there's nothing we can do about that or something like that. It seems like that would be relevant to a NEPA analysis somehow. It could be relevant.
I think the NEPA analysis turns on really what the environmental impact of the project is, and not...
Well, because their argument, you heard them, their argument is that you didn't discuss mitigation measures, right? And so certainly things like if you did the fulsome mitigation discussion they wanted, part of that might be, you know, we'd like to, you know, not have this happen, but there's no way we could not have, I mean, we'd have to go buy the water, you know, buy the water rights from other people to give it to Fernley to keep this from happening because they don't have a water right or something. It seems, I guess I'm answering my own question here, but it's hard to me to see how that's not somehow relevant to the NEPA analysis.
Well, going back to your initial question, so the water rights are adjudicated, the groundwater rights are adjudicated under state law, not federal law, and under the Ord Ditch Decree.
Yeah, I assume their position, though, would be something like, we get these cases sometimes where, I forget what they're called, like where a tribe says that, you know, we've got a water right that from the, that came with the, there's a name for it, but we got a water right that came with the giving us of the, of our reservation, reserve water. And so they will litigate those questions in order to get put in at a higher priority than, so just because you have adjudicated water rights, this thing in theory, I assume their argument would be this, they could end up somehow above, you know, they could get up in there somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think even just turning back to the merits of this case, I think even if we were to somehow assume that there was some sort of legal right to that groundwater seepage, and we don't believe that there is, but even if there were, that wouldn't change the fact that the agency here reasonably did its NEPA analysis.
So your view, I guess, to summarize this would be, okay, I'll spot you that it is relevant, but even if it's relevant, your NEPA analysis was sufficient.
The NEPA analysis here was reasonable. When you look at the agency's analysis of the alternatives, they reasonably considered multiple alternatives. Contrary to what plaintiffs have said, they actually considered 14 non-lining alternatives or 14 non-lining elements before even conducting the NEPA analysis, the formal environmental impact study, and they rejected those options for a variety of reasons and then laid out those reasons in the environmental impact study. In addition, the Bureau of Reclamation adequately disclosed the impacts of the various alternatives and conducted a thorough analysis of that. And again, under Seven County, a substantial amount of deference is due to the agency's analysis here. And the agency also reasonably considered mitigation. In fact, in the record of decision itself, there's actually a page that discusses mitigation measures that, you know, goes on for a couple of pages, and it talks about the mitigation related to the construction. Those are all direct impacts of the project itself. And it discusses mitigation with respect to the artificial groundwater recharge and mitigation with respect to the National Historic Preservation Act as well. So that's in the record of decision in the excerpts of record on pages 85 and 86. So overall, we would say that under Seven County here, the agency reasonably analyzed everything that it was supposed to analyze. The Supreme Court's decision in Seven County makes clear that the central principle of judicial review in NEPA cases is deference. And the agency acted within its discretion here, made reasonable decisions, and is entitled to that substantial deference, especially with respect to the assessment of the feasibility of alternatives. Those are scientific judgments during which the court should be at its most deferential.
So what review is left after that decision? I mean, if we're supposed to defer to the agency in terms of what scientific study to engage in and which alternatives to look at and how to assess them, what work is left for the courts?
I mean, I think at that point, the court's review, as the Supreme Court said in Seven County, is a somewhat limited one, and it's to ensure that the decisions weren't completely arbitrary and capricious, that they weren't relying on something completely flawed or inaccurate, but that overall substantial deference is owed to the agency's analysis. And the Supreme Court was clear in saying that when assessing significant environmental effects and feasible impacts for purposes of NEPA, an agency will invariably make a series of fact-dependent, context-specific, and policy-laden choices about the depth and breadth of its inquiry, and also the length, content, and level of detail of the resulting environmental impact statement. And that courts should afford a substantial deference and not micromanage those agency choices so long as they fall within a broad zone of reasonableness. So in answer to your question, Judge Forrest, I think the question would be whether or not the decisions fall within a broad zone of reasonableness, but that in most cases there's going to be substantial deference to the agency's assessments.
Yeah, I mean, that clearly seems to be the Supreme Court's message. Putting it into practice is a little bit interesting in terms of, I mean, how am I supposed to know if something is arbitrary if I'm not supposed to look behind the curtain as to, you know, what you chose this scientific approach versus that one and whatever, right? Like,
right,
I don't know.
Right.
I'm not a scientist.
Right. And I think that is why the Supreme Court in seven counties sort of shielded some of those determinations from review, because there are engineers who, you know, spend significant amount of time developing these alternatives, doing research studies. I mean, here we had a feasibility study with respect to the vinyl cutoff walls, three different locations tested, and, you know, two out of three locations failed because of the rocky, cobbly soil and those vinyl sheet walls.
And of course, I mean, your friend on the other side of the case says, well, you should have done more than just three test sites. And, you know, and I suppose your answer to that is we get to choose.
Right. I mean, that's within the agency's discretion to decide. And I think
so by what metric am I supposed to figure out if that was arbitrary or not? Or is there a metric for me to do that?
I mean, I think that in that case, you would apply substantial deference. I think merely saying that we disagree and we think that there should have been more analysis is not enough to establish that that was flawed. So, and that's what we have here. We have a disagreement about, we think that there should have been more done. And for our part, we think enough was done. But merely disagreeing about how many studies would be necessary to reject a particular option is kind of the quintessential thing that would be rejected by Seven County as something that would be revisited by a court to reconsider. Does the court have any further questions?
Guess not.
All right. Well, we would urge the court to affirm the decision of the district court, and thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, counsel.
Just really quickly, I don't want to belabor this point, but Judge Van Dyke, we agree with you. That's why we included a claim for declarative relief on our right as a supplemental jurisdiction claim. The district court threw it out, and the previous panel, this court, upheld that. So that's why it's not there. With regards to the question of where the deference question and what is arbitrary and capricious and how do you determine that, yes, there's deference when it comes to weighing certain technical aspects. But the one thing the agency doesn't get deference on is waiving any aspect of the law. The law says that they have to do certain things, and they're not allowed to waive those requirements, those legal requirements. And one of those legal requirements is the mitigation discussion. One of those legal requirements is to consider alternatives that have that cooperating agencies. And keep in mind, Fernley's here is a cooperating agency. We were invited by them to be a cooperating agency in this because we have specialized technical expertise and because we are the people most committed to the health of that aquifer and the environment around it. We're the ones that live there.
So here's from Seven County that I think gives you a very uphill road here, and it is: for speculative assessment, predictive scientific judgments, courts should be at their most deferential. And isn't all of the things that you're talking about fitting into that bucket of scientific judgments, speculation about how things are going to play out, and the agency gets to make their decision about how they're going to investigate those things and the extent that they're going to do that, and then they have to write down what they did so that everybody can see it and be informed about what the government is doing? But if we're at our most deferential, what space is there for us to get involved?
The place is where they're, like I said, they're violating the actual letter of the law. The requirement was that they use the best available science to now do this technical analysis. They didn't do that. They had the best available science, this Desert Research Institute groundwater model. Everybody agrees that was the best available science. And contrary to the footnote in their brief, it was designed exactly for this purpose. And it has been used for this purpose to determine impacts to the aquifer from different projects. That's the purpose that it was created for. They failed to use it to identify the magnitudes and the severity of these impacts so that they could have a proper mitigation discussion as required by the law. This is not a situation like in Seven County where we're talking about super attenuated impacts 2,000 miles away. All we're talking about is we wanted them to study the impacts right at the project, where it occurs in the city of Fernley and to our aquifer. And instead, they improperly, narrowly defined it to just 100 feet. The project area that they studied was 100 feet on either side of the center line, 50 feet on either side of the center line of the canal coming through, and ignore and put their head in the sand like the proverbial ostrich, ignoring everything outside of that 100-foot barrier. That is not what the law requires. And so that's where it becomes arbitrary and capricious. The very definition of arbitrary and capricious is not following the law and the regulations in place that they need to follow and making a decision without following that. I was up at 2 in the morning rereading again for the 100th time this EIS this morning in preparation for this hearing today. And I just ask you, as you read through it, just think, if you were an executive level decision maker, would you know, after reading this EIS, would you know the groundwater levels in this basin will decline by 90 feet in the first 20 years after the project and continue declining afterwards? No, you wouldn't know that because it's nowhere in there. Would you know that 78% of local groundwater wells will fail, not just have an impact, fail, and not be able to produce water under this project? It's not in there. You wouldn't see it. Would you know that there is credible evidence in the record that that land subsidence will occur when the aquifer goes down, as we've seen in the Central Valley? When the aquifer goes down, land subsides. And this is a particularly seismically active zone. There's a fault that runs right through the middle of Fernley. And it could trigger those faults, that type of land subsidence. You wouldn't know that because it's not in the EIS. The executive, the whole point of an EIS is to give an executive level decision maker full information about the impacts that their decision could have, so that they can understand, even if they choose to do it, even if as the Supreme Court said in Seven County, they still choose to make a bad decision, okay, but they need to have the information to make that decision, similar to like an informed consent standard in medical practice. People need to know the effects of what they're doing. We urge you to overturn the district court and vacate the ruling. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. Thanks to you to all of you for your briefing and argument in this very interesting case. This matter is submitted, and this panel is adjourned until tomorrow at 9 a.m. You'll have a different person in the center square tomorrow. Oh, and one last thing. I wanted to thank my two externs. This is pretty much their last day. Isaac and Henry, thank you for all your free service this summer. Appreciate it.